It's a busy time of year, and so appreciate having everybody be here and tune in online and practice together. I've noticed something of a theme in recent talks by teachers here, including in one of my own talks. So last month, in November, on the 25th, Zen Master Zhongbong reminded Tuesday practitioners that in terms of Zen practice, we already have everything we need for waking up. And then a week later, I was giving an after-practice talk, and I quoted Zen Master De Heng of Korea, who said, "You must not try to search outside of yourself. Take your inherent nature as your teacher." Then, earlier this month, during her first talk of the retreat, Anne Pope Sanim spoke of the simplicity of Zen in our practice, emphasizing that when we practice, we aim for just sitting with nothing else added. And finally, in his formal talk during Buddha's Enlightenment, the Buddha's Enlightenment Day ceremony, a couple of days later, Zen Master Zhongbong emphasized once again that each of us possesses the seed of awakening. Each of us has that in us. So the thread, the theme that seems to be running through all of these talks is the message that each one of us, as we are, dragging around our sack of karma is enough. We're enough, and we have enough. We have awakened nature, not in the future, but now, even as we sit here. So our practice is not to gain something, but to reveal what's already here in us, or with us. Isn't that great? That's good news. You know, I, like Anne Pope Sanim, I think keeping practice simple is really important. You know, there's a sea of questions we could ask about Zen practice and our essential nature, and so many ways to talk about it. And there's a vast library of written teachings about available to us, and then some, you know, all over the world. Books about Zen and Buddhism are chock full of pearls of wisdom, and some of them are exciting and fun to read. I remember something Tim Callahan, Jita Pope Sanim, said when he was teaching here. He said that the Buddha's words sparkle. And that really struck me, because when I read things attributed to the Buddha, that's how it seems. You know, they just have something. They sparkle. They shimmer. So I still read some of these books, and I find inspiration through them. And maybe you do the same. But reading, or as we might say, thinking, as we've all heard, if we've hung around here for very long, that can only take us so far. I want to mention that, bring the Zen circle in, because the Zen circle, I think, can be applied to in this, in terms of what I'm trying to say here, so in diagrammatic form. So it's, if you might be familiar with the Zen circle, you might not be. It's a teaching from Zen Master Sung San. That he brought to us. So at 0 degrees, we might say something like this: things are this way and not that way. And the way I see things is how they are. You know, this is the right way. End of story. This is truth as we might experience it through the clouded lens of our karma. At 0 degrees, we're most firmly rooted in this realm of opposites thinking. And in our calcified opinions about how it is. That's at 0 degrees. And then moving along the circle, we come to 90 degrees. And 0 degrees is sometimes referred to, this point is referred to as karma eye. And then at 90 degrees is thinking eye. So in this realm of thinking at 90 degrees, this is the realm of thinking, ideas, words, speech, you know, interesting books, that sort of thing. And we've started to ask questions here, and our questions might include, you know, is what I believe the truth? Or could this way and that way both be valid? Both be true? Or both be untrue? What's the best way for me to help myself and help other people? And what am I anyway? So these kinds of questions are important. These questions can guide our practice in looking at ourselves and helping us understand how things really are. But in asking these questions, if we look deeply at any of them, you know, as long as we're still playing with words and thoughts and trying to figure things out, it's likely we won't find truly satisfactory answers. You know, if we stay in this realm, and but it is likely we will generate more questions and maybe more ideas. I listen to audiobooks sometimes, and I was listening to one called The Stone Reader. The Stone Reader is an anthology on philosophy. It's for non-philosophers. It was produced by the New York Times, I think. And in one of the essays, it's a collection of essays and writings. In one of the essays, it's conveyed that although philosophers are good at asking and exploring questions, they all come up with different answers to the same questions. So that's my point. You know, if we're still dealing with ideas and words, we can come up with all kinds of things that seem true. But if the fruit of Zen practice could be attained through thinking, then we would all be practicing thinking, you know, and instead of practicing in a Dharma room like this one, we might be in a library reading books or, you know, meeting with people and discussing ideas. But that is not the method of Zen. In Zen practice, we don't eschew thinking, we don't get rid of it necessarily, but neither do we depend on it. And instead, in practice, particularly in meditation practice, in this formal practice that we do, we practice letting go of our ideas, letting go of thinking. If on the Zen circle, we gradually let go of thinking, and as we move towards 80 degrees, 180 degrees at the top of the circle, we step into this direct experience, unclouded territory of not knowing, of before thinking. So in doing this kind of practice, we are watering the seeds of awakening. And it's because this kind of practice does not depend on outside knowledge or some outside authority. It's because of that that we can say we're already fully equipped for this journey. We have everything we need. We have our Buddha nature already. And this practice of letting go of what we might believe in terms of, you know, ideas, by letting go of that, then we open the door to just being awake. A couple of weeks ago, we had an after-practice discussion about managing anxiety. This was a really good discussion. I'm sure we've all had our own experiences of these kinds of difficulties. Well, maybe not, but a lot of us have. And nobody wants to feel that kind of pain, the pain of anxiety, depression, despair, loneliness, or any of the other really difficult and maybe even dreadful conditions that come along sometimes with being human. I myself have experienced some pretty bad depression, or at least that's what I called it at the time. It lasted a long time, and it was awful. So maybe you can relate to that. I would not necessarily prescribe Zen practice as a primary treatment for serious anxiety or depression. Now, which is not to say that practice doesn't help. It might. But it's not necessarily the cure in the short term. You know, in the same way, you know, if our house is on fire, you know, sitting down to do Zen meditation is not necessarily the right action. There are other things we can do. Call the fire department. So, you know, if we're really impaired, if we're really having difficulty, you know, just practicing meditation might not be the first line treatment. Zen, after all, is a lifelong practice and not necessarily first aid. So here's a story. Zen Master Wu Bong with the Quantum School was here leading a retreat one time. And this was in the early 2000s. And like everybody else that attended that retreat, I met with him for a Dharma dialogue down in our Dharma dialogue room, and I was, and that was really kind of maybe not at the peak, but you know, after the peak of when I was feeling really awful and I was still not so good. And I was talking to him how I could about how I was feeling, and he said, "Take a pill." You know, he said, "You don't have to feel that way necessarily." So that was good Zen advice. In terms of, and I'm not saying taking a pill is the right thing. And in fact, I didn't follow that advice. I'm just saying this came from a Zen master. You know, he wasn't necessarily attached to some idea about Zen. Like Zen is going to snap you out of this problem if you just practice harder. And I'm glad he didn't just admonish me to train harder at that time. He gave me options, which I thought was great. I thought that was great teaching. So, be that as it may, examining our suffering is an aspect of Zen practice and a motivating factor. Here's what Bodhidharma supposedly said. Bodhidharma, if he actually existed, this was attributed to him. He said, "Every suffering is a Buddha seed because suffering impels mortals to seek wisdom." Zen Master De Hang said something similar. She was a contemporaneous teacher. She's gone now. I think she died in 2012. She said, "Although it may seem like it might not seem like it at the time, later you will realize that the suffering you are experiencing is actually Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who have come to purify you and help you grow." Now, I don't dismiss suffering. I believe in it. And I know that by itself, if it's bad enough, it can be really bad. It can even kill us. Perhaps my takeaway suggestion then would be that, you know, when we find ourselves in the midst of our suffering, one thing we can do is remind ourselves that we're not yet seeing the big picture, and that even now, in the way that matters most, we are fundamentally okay. We're enough. Last month, I had the privilege of participating in a week-long retreat in New Mexico. With Zen Master Zhang Ji and a couple of other teachers. The two other teachers were practiced in the Japanese Rinzai tradition. So a lot of the forms for the retreat, a lot of the things that we did were in that style, in the Rinzai style. And we did some chanting every day. We did Kwansin Bosal chanting. And we did the Heart Sutra in English like we do here, but we also did some of the chants that they do in that other tradition. And one of these chants was a tribute to Kwansin Bosal, or as they say in Japanese, to Kanzeon. Kanzeon, Kanzeon, you know, through the day Kanzeon, in the night Kanzeon. And one of the lines in this chant was this: "Our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure." Eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. So as a point of faith, that line really stuck with me. It's hard to practice when we're in pain. In our after-practice discussion a couple of weeks ago, Julie, if I understood her correctly, spoke about using her thoughts to reason her way into feeling differently and feeling better. And this really makes sense. We can think our way into another perspective. So even if the way of Zen and might not be the way of thinking our way into enlightenment, we can think our way onto our cushions. We can reason our way into the utility and efficacy of Zen practice. We can reason our way into sitting down and practicing skillfully. And then, from that point, by letting go of good and bad, even for short periods, we loosen our grip on our relative experience and step toward realizing our ever-present, never-gone, true nature. So, thank you for listening, and may all of us and all beings be free of suffering.